You're listening to a special series of Between Two Flags for UNA Canada's Green Corps program. Through regular podcasts, Green Corps will invite a wide range of experts to discuss complex environmental, economic, and social issues. Live tweet as you listen with hashtag Between Two Flags.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our second podcast of Between Two Flags for Canada Green Corps. Today we have as our honored guest, Tom Rand, who is a Canadian climate change expert and clean technology venture capitalist. He is the lead clean tech advisor at Mars Discovery District in Toronto and managing partner of the privately backed Arcturn Ventures. Also sits on the boards of a number of clean energy companies and organizations, including Environmental Defense Canada and Cape Farewell. In 2009, Rand became the clean tech practice lead at Mars Discovery District, where he remains a senior advisor. He is also a managing partner of Arcturn Ventures, a fund that provides early stage risk capital to the most promising Mars clean tech companies. And he sits on the boards of Morgan Solar, HydroStore, Polar, Sapphire, and many others. In 2007, Rand and his business partner, Anthony Arts, began renovations on an abandoned building in Toronto, which in January 2011 became the Planet Traveller Hotel. The building was retrofitted to use geothermal and solar thermal electricity, LED lighting, and drain water heat recovery. Planet Traveller was the first building in Toronto to arrange for geothermal piping to be laid under city-owned property. Rand has appeared on Canadian TV shows and is a frequent public speaker on the science, politics, and economics of climate change, as well as clean technology, venture capital, and innovation. He is a regular contributor on The Exchange with Amanda Lang. Tom, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
What we've done is we've asked our Green Corps participants and their employers to submit a few questions for us to mull over and discuss on the show today. We will be leaving those towards the end of the show. And right now, I would just like to get a little sense of how you got interested in these issues of climate change and energy and sustainability. Can you pinpoint a certain moment in your life or event that that sparked this interest?
Good question. I come from a family of scientists. My father's a professor of microbiology, and we've always just sort of been scientifically literate. And I, at a very young age, recall, by young age, I mean being a teenager.
Sure, okay.
Having, fist-pounding, table-pounding discussions around the family dinner table around climate and why, the politics wasn't taking seriously what was clearly emerging risk on the side of science. You know, my parents are classic sort of academics in the sense that they believe that, you know, public debate, while it can veer wildly here and there, will end up, approximating the truth, right? That, you know, given enough rounds of discussion, you settle on the truth. And I think we've discovered in the years since then that that's probably not the truth.
Right.
But in any case, I've always been an overly educated observer of climate. It does keep me up at night. I worry about the heat deaths of our ecosystem. I worry about the risks it poses, particularly to people in the developing world who don't have the capacity really to build up a robust defense against the coming storms. So it's always kept me up at night. And, I'm an entrepreneur is what I do. I built a software company back in the day, and so I have an entrepreneurial sort of interest. And so getting into clean tech, investing in clean tech companies and helping build the technology components of our response to climate really was my way of getting on the ice and trying to make a difference on this. And I there was one moment that I do recall. I was having a dinner with some folks from the World Wildlife Fund who had invited me, and Toby Heaps was there. Toby is the, the founder and editor of the Corporate Knights magazine.
Right.
And he sort of threw the gauntlet down and challenged me to do something substantial on this file. And other people at the table were all involved, you know, negotiating in Kyoto or running Corporate Knights magazine or whatnot.
Right.
And I really just felt like an overeducated observer. And it was really at that moment that I challenged myself, having sold my software company, to get into the game and put my capital to work and my talent and my time. And that was really sort of a catalyzing moment for sure, inspired by the people that I met that evening.
Wow, that's very interesting. And I remember in the book, in your book, Waking the Frog, Solutions for Our Climate Change Paralysis, which we'll have a few questions very shortly. But I remember you mentioning your mother and father's academic backgrounds and how that, you know, really led to or kind of guided your path towards where you are now, as well as the sale of a software company. And I guess that must have been a time in your life where you knew that you could make a substantial difference. Tom, you just mentioned science literacy, and that's a term along with energy literacy and climate literacy that we are trying to promote and share with the Green Corps participants and the Canadian public. Could you speak a little bit towards how you feel climate literacy or energy literacy could be improved generally in Canada, either through education or the government assistance or the work of civil society or the leadership of the private sector and their CSR campaigns? And I guess a follow-up to that, if it's not too much, but what do you feel is the current state of climate literacy in Canada?
That's a really good question. So I don't know that there's a single source of education on climate. I do think the public is intuitively conscious of the threat that we're under, but I don't think there's a lot of people that really understand how profound this threat is. I think we've gotten past the point where people are really wondering if it's... I mean, there'll always be people that simply don't accept the science. That's life in the free world. Mm-hmm. But I do think the majority of Canadians and the majority of sort of engaged citizens understand this is a risk. I think what's missing is an understanding of just how profound this risk is. Mm-hmm. In my view, I actually think it poses a fundamental stresses to civic society. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you listen to the word... I was actually at a planetary security conference in The Hague about a month ago, and there you had very sober, intelligent sort of, you know, generals, military experts, security experts talking in language that was actually quite frightening, right? The Department of Defense in the United States views climate change, they call it a threat multiplier.
Right.
And they've identified the Syrian crisis as being exacerbated by precisely what will happen as climate change begins to kick in.
Sure.
Water stresses, right? There was the longest drought in living memory in Syria, and farmers were moving from the rural countryside to the cities, which provided that cauldron of activity that lit up that storm. So their language is sort of uncompromising. And they put it in qualitative terms, right? There are certain kinds of risks we simply cannot bear, rather than the kind of dry economic terms that people talk about it in my world, where, you know, when you look to act on climate, you have to do this big cost justification of it, right? When people talk about the carbon price in Alberta, it's always about, you know, are we getting value for our money and so on. And I think that's an impoverished conversation. In terms of going back to your main question about education, I think, obviously, the place to start is the educational system in our schools.
Yeah.
But I think the problem there is, you know, by the time you have a generation of people educated on climate, I mean, it's too late.
It's too late.
You know, the time it takes to have your hands on the levers of power is an entire career.
Yeah.
Right? So the challenge we have, I think, is how is it that we educate those whose hands are on the levers of power, the people on Bay Street, Wall Street, the people in our banks, running our energy companies? And these are older people, typically, because that's how long it takes to get into that kind of position.
Right.
And there, I actually think one of the most important points of engagement is around the family dinner table.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to put off an articulate, passionate young person who presents to their family at dinner the question, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing about this? You know, and you know, this will be something that people will face in years to come. What did you do when the world got hot, Mom? Dad, and I think that's a very powerful force. So I think that's where you bridge the gap, the generational gap, the time gap between when young people get educated through, you know, non-governmental organizations like yours, through their schools, through their, you know, local leaders, and through, you know, general media, right through to the corridors of power. Is I think that you have those difficult conversations around the family table. I don't think you can understate that. But I would finish on one point where I do think what's missing in our public debate, I mean, the business community has begun at least to acknowledge that the problem is real. But what hasn't happened yet is an endorsement or an engagement by the business community that acknowledges that incrementalism will not do the job. We are far too late in the game now that we can tinker around the edges of our economic system, you know, with a carbon price of $20 and think that that's going to get us anywhere. This is a far more profound problem. We have maybe a generation to rebuild our energy systems from the ground up. That's an enormous economic opportunity, right?
Sure, so
that's
one
way to talk about it. But but the no nonsense, no hold barred, you know, admission from business leaders that, you know what, we are in a pile of trouble.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure how we're going to solve this problem, but by God, we're going to try.
Yeah.
I have yet to really hear that from the private sector, from corporate leaders, and I think that's a missing voice. And I think without that voice at the table, you will have a cultural divide emerging over the next decade or two as climate begins to bite and people get scared.
Yeah.
I mean, we found there, you know, there's room for demagogues to breathe when people are worried.
And
this is nothing. So I think it's important for business leaders to understand they are on the wrong side of history right now.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 or 15 years from now, when people are looking for a scapegoat and people are going to look for someone to blame, when, you know, loaf of bread costs $10, they're going to point to Wall Street, they're going to point to business leaders and say, where were you?
Right.
And so that's another reason, just from their own sense of self-interest, I think the business community needs to stand up and be an explicit part of this educational process.
Interesting.
And so I'll end it there.
Okay, well, no, that's very good. And you've answered my second question about your opinion on insight on Canada's carbon pricing mechanisms. But I mean, it's a powerful message, Tom. And I think you're very right on a number of points. I hope that at some points I was that articulate youth around the family dinner table. But my sister and I have managed to sway my mother and father on a few of these issues. But you're right. I mean, there's a number of actors that need to step up to the table, and the financial resources, the financial capacity, and that the private sector would bring is, as you rightly mentioned in your book, absolutely critical for investing the trillions of dollars that we need to essentially rebuild an energy system in a generation. And your overarching points are well taken. Tom, I thoroughly enjoyed your 2014 book, Waking the Frog, Solutions for Our Climate Change Paralysis. I have to thank a colleague at United Nations Association in Canada for lending it to me over Christmas, and I finished it within a few days at the cabin. It was extremely readable, very optimistic. I almost came away feeling that you felt, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you know, the engineering challenges are immense, but known in a way. You know, it's not insurmountable. It's really getting the financial resources and the political will and the public opinion or the public support to really start making things happen. You know, what was it, I guess, if you would like to comment on that, my follow-up question to that is, you know, what was it like researching, writing Wake the Frog? And at the end of the book, you very heavily promote a price on carbon. And I was wondering if you would care to offer some insight and opinion on Canada's carbon pricing mechanisms that have been proposed.
Sure. Well, in terms of the engineering possibilities, you know, look, humans, we are very, very clever monkeys. We've done, you know, amazing things, right? I mean, if you look historically at this century, putting a person on the moon, splitting the atom. I mean, the amount of technology deployed by the military is absolutely mind-numbingly impressive in a very dark kind of way.
Right.
There is no question in my mind, if we concentrate our capital, our entrepreneurial creativity, and our engineering might to this problem, that we would solve it. I mean, we sit at a time in history where there has never been a better capacity to manipulate matter at a nanoscale.
Mm-hmm.
We sit on trillions and trillions of dollars of capital sloshing around in money market pension funds. Our engineering might, this is the machinery, the industrial machinery that we've built, that we sit on, is absolutely capable of solving this problem.
Yeah.
The question is, how is it that you have that machine turned to the task at hand? I mean, in the Second World War, the United States, you know, on a patriotic fervor, you know, rejigged their entire industrial economy to a war machine. And they did that in the space of 12 to 18 months.
Yeah.
There was an identifiable, you know, boogeyman there, right? It's, you know, Hitler and the war. And so it was easy to mobilize public opinion around that central action. And I think that's what we're missing right now. We're missing the boogeyman.
Mm.
Because in climate change, I mean, we can, you know, point fingers at, you know, Exxon and we can identify all the bad actors. But, you know, underneath it, we are all complicit, right? You know, we all use fuels. We're all part of the economic system. And so I think it's the lack of a boogeyman that makes this really difficult to rally the kind of, you know, fervor that we need to turn our economy essentially on a dime.
Yeah.
When I say generation, that's like turning it on a dime. And that's what's hard, right? And we are now entering an era, you know, where, you know, this threat seems abstract in the future. I mean, it's sort of coming to bear on us as we speak,
mm-hmm.
but it remains an abstraction. And fighting an abstraction is very difficult. That's not what our brains are designed to do.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think that's the challenge. If we can find a way to articulate, you know, not necessarily the enemy, but the reasons why we want to do this. And that's why I usually try to talk about climate risk from the perspective of economic opportunity. I'm not being disingenuous. I'm not sort of trying to avoid the difficult truths of climate risk, but you want to try to put it into a language that people are able to grab onto, regardless of their political stripes and regardless of their age and regardless of where they live.
Right.
And when you talk about, you know, building a new energy type economy that is built on technology and it brings a future of abundance and so on, that's a kind of vision people can grab. It's got jobs, it's got wealth, it's got progress all embedded in that story.
Sure.
And that's the kind of story that I think we need to begin to tell. We need to begin to articulate what this solution looks like, what the economic benefits are to Canada, just from a self-interested point of view,
right.
of getting in front of this parade.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of vision I think that you can build a responsive capacity. And again, it's around unlocking this giant industrial machine that we've built to solve this problem. That's really the fundamental question, and that's at the bottom of Waking the Frog, right?
Yeah.
How is it that we unlock that engineering potential? Because it is there, and we can, in theory, solve this problem.
Interesting. And so how was it going through the process of writing the book?
Cathartic.
Oh, well, I bet it was, yeah, actually.
Yeah, it was cathartic. And, you know, like any writing, it when you articulate an idea, it goes from fuzzy to sharp.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the process of bringing into sharp relief a lot of the ideas that I had around psychology, you know, economic models, policy, that markets, that kind of thing. And bringing them into sharp focus, I certainly learned a lot. But it was cathartic in the sense that I was enormously frustrated at the lack of articulate business voices talking
yeah.
turkey about climate risk. And I was tired of all the noise on the surface, just people yelling at each other.
Sure.
And I was interested in getting beneath all that noise to what are the actual pieces of machinery that we've built in our economic, legal, and economic systems. What's that machinery look like, and why is it frozen? Because we are capable of building and defining the rules by which we live, unlike the poor frog in the pot of water, right?
Right,
we're
exactly,
human.
Yeah.
But to do that, we need to be self-aware, and we need to be self-aware in ways that I was afraid we are not, right?
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really looked into the assumptions we make and our economic model. Why are we talking about, you know, nickels and dimes when we're talking about the survival of the planet, the ecosystem in which we evolved?
Exactly.
And I wanted to get to the root of those arguments and try to change the language by which we speak about them, rather than simply continue to argue in the same manner. And that's really what Frog was designed to do.
Well, I mean, I would encourage all our listeners to find Waking the Frog and take a read. It's it won't take you very long. It's very as I mentioned, it's very readable. It leaves a very optimistic view and quite informative. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Man, we've got a lot to go through. I've got three questions from our Green Corps participants. I wanted to, but before we do that, I mean, you had already mentioned, and I'd just like you to expand a little bit. You know, I'm actually from Edmonton, and certainly going back home for Christmas was there were heated debates about the carbon tax, and of course in Ontario with the cap and trade and high electricity prices, there's a lot of controversy and troubles around that. Clearly, you know, the externalization of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, you know, I would say, you know, and just my opinion, that it really can't continue and that a price on carbon is needed. But, you know, you mentioned just kind of tinkering around the edges. And so what is your opinion on Canada's plans? I mean, $50 a ton by 2022, I believe. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a big gap between what's needed to really solve the problem and move the needle on carbon in a way that's relevant to climate risk and what's politically possible, right? And this is where it's a real It's an art. You know, I actually think that what's politically possible is defined by the kind of leadership that one shows.
Sure.
So I don't know if we've reached the limit of what's politically possible yet, but for sure, it's not as easy as just define. I mean, the National Roundtable on the Economy and the Environment, which was you know, disbanded by Harper, but they did some great work while they were around, and they did some analysis on, well, what would the price on carbon need to be for us to hit things like our Kyoto commitment?
Right.
And it's not $50 in 5 years. It's, you know, $200, $300.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, but is that politically palatable? Probably not.
No.
So I think this is where the rubber hits the road, and one needs to be careful about saying, you know, once you price carbon, you're done, because that's not really the point. If the carbon price were high enough to move the needle, it would cause enormous economic dislocation, particularly, you know, among people who, you know, having trouble heating their homes and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So you do have to have a suite of policies. You really do have to think about what are ways that we can accelerate this transition aside from just putting a price in play. And that's over the short term and the long term. You know, in the short term, for example, something they're doing in Quebec is if I own a giant, you know, building or a factory, I can actually take 10 years of carbon credits that I would normally accumulate by retrofitting my factory and have them given to me on day one to help pay for my retrofit.
Oh, wow.
Limited by a three-year payback.
So okay.
You can't put it. But what all that does is it says, look, there are changes that need to be made in the economy. We put a price signal in place. But business people don't make decisions. They're not perfectly rational, right? So
sure.
If someone presented someone with a project and said, here's a four-year payback, you would think someone would take that project because that's a lot more money than you earn putting your money in other investments. But that's not the way it works. People normally you know, use operating budgets to make those kinds of decisions, and so the payback needs to be a lot shorter. In other words, what Quebec is doing by providing on day one the net present value of 10 years of greenhouse gas reductions is saying, we're not going to spend any more to get this done. We're just going to spend the money now rather than 4 years from now.
Right.
So they've figured out a way to accelerate or catalyze market activity before the market would normally move.
Hmm.
And so there's lots of ways in which we can do that. Ontario is thinking about that through its Green Bank. Yeah. You know, those are sort of short-term catalyzing bits of policy. Long term, I think you really need to think about how is it that we accelerate, you know, fossil fuel busting technologies into the market.
Sure.
You know, that's another sort of long term accelerant. But we need to really think about accelerants. You know, there's a limit as to what the public will tolerate in terms of a price on carbon. I think that price is actually much higher than we think, particularly.
Sure.
If you make it revenue neutral,
yeah,
or largely revenue neutral, and you lower payroll taxes or sales taxes or something like that. So I think there are ways to position this where there is more appetite for a higher price once people realize it's not just a cash grab. But in addition to that, you really need to think about, you know, gaps in the market that you can fill with well-placed policy, ways to accelerate a transition that is otherwise inevitable, but you want to shorten the time to make that transition.
Hmm.
And I think that's one of the key pieces we need to think about as we think about climate policy. So
yeah.
Pricing carbon is important. It's central. You can't do this without pricing carbon. It's the most useful tool we have. But it's not the only tool we need to deploy. You know, if it was 20 years ago, we could put a price on carbon, have it climb $5 a year, and over 20, 25 years, we'd solve the problem.
Yeah.
We don't have that luxury anymore. And
no.
So right now, for me, it's all about accelerate, accelerate, accelerate. What are things we can do to accelerate that transition?
Really interesting. And I know in the book you were talking about, was it advanced geothermal, carbon capture, and the third one was, I think, was it nuclear, the new generation breeder reactors?
Yeah. I think those are the big boys, right?
Yeah.
Of those three, you know, I think the one with the most potential is actually enhanced geothermal.
Yeah.
It's where you drill, you know, deep enough, you hit very, very hot, dry rock, and you fracture that rock the same way we fracture for nat gas.
Right.
But you're going way farther down. You're not fracking for gas. You're fracking for heat.
Yeah, maybe 10 or 12 kilometers.
Yeah, there's absolutely mind-numbing amounts of it down there. We could run our entire civilization on it. But it takes time to get that technology mature.
Right.
You know, and again, this is one of those technologies that you need public investment. Because the private sector is not motivated to be the first mover on this stuff because it's not the kind of thing that when you figure out how to do it, you patent it. Right,
right,
so like
exactly.
An iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, this is sort of learning by doing. It's just good engineering. And so you need to, I think, to sort of seed the marketplace with a good, you know, public-private partnership to sort of figure out how to make enhanced geothermal work and then share those best practices. But that, I think, is one of the most promising technologies, but it will take a decade or two to mature,
yeah.
And it would be great if we could have started on that 15 years ago.
Yeah, that was a common sentiment that I got in your book as well. And, you know, just... I can't imagine how frustrating some of this might be for those people who have worked on this for their entire lives. You know, I'm thinking about a baby boomer generation and a few people in particular. But, you know, I think there's a number of things that I might have to have you back on the show for. There's so much to discuss. I would like to get to these questions if it's okay with you.
Certainly.
There's three from the team, and then I have kind of one general follow-up question at the end. So this question is from Burgess, who is currently a climate change intern at AgriTeam. And AgriTeam provides a wide range of capacity development services to government, private, and nonprofit clients in the international and domestic markets. And their purpose is twofold: to help community, industry, and government leaders to achieve their goals in a progressive and sustainable manner, and to promote Canadian excellence worldwide. Burgess's question is as follows. He says, "Hi, Mr. Rand. Given both the pressing issue of climate change and hence emissions reductions and a globalized economy, how do we ensure that Canadian firms and others which operate around the globe follow global best practices in all their operations, rather than to the minimums which might be found in some countries they operate in with less advanced climate mitigation targets and programs?" I think it's a great question. You know, it's tragedy of the commons at its fundamental. So what would you say to Burgess?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it does capture a very general problem about racing to the bottom.
Yeah,
there's some really great work being done on this. I would actually, again, I'd refer to Corporate Knights magazine and a few others who have done a lot of yeoman's work in trying to describe to the investment community what the long-term risks are when you don't follow those kinds of best practices. So in other words, a company might have a better short-term profit margin because they can dump their crap in the local creek.
Right.
But there is a long-term potential cost because of legal repercussions, long-term competitiveness in other jurisdictions that they don't incorporate best practices and therefore they can't translate them into other parts of their operation,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so on and so forth. In other words, they're trying to translate best practices into long-term profitability and demonstrating empirically, looking at publicly traded companies and saying, look, if you actually only pick out the companies that follow best practices, look, they happen to be more profitable over the long term. So in other words, drive investment away from companies that don't follow best practices on the premise that there are long-term risks that are unaccounted for in those short-term operations. And so again, that's trying to translate something that is an environmental good into a practical investment decision where the better actor comes out ahead. And you know, so I would sort of point you to the direction of Corporate Knights, that they've done a lot of work on exactly how it is that you make that case to the investment community.
That's interesting. That's a fantastic answer. I'm sure Burgess will be pleased with that. And I would encourage all listeners to find out a little bit more about what Tom just said. Our next question, just in the interest of time, I'm just going to keep going through these, and I think your answers and the brief answers that you can give are sort of a catalyst for just continued learning after the podcast as well. So if there's other resources that you think about that might be useful to some of our listeners, then please don't be afraid to throw those in. The second question is from Jenna, who is an energy solutions advisor at Efficiency Nova Scotia. And Efficiency Nova Scotia is Canada's first energy efficiency utility. Working with more than 100 local partners, they have helped 225,000 program participants complete energy efficiency projects, preventing the release of 590,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions annually. Her question is as follows, and it's a little lengthy, so just I'll try and make this palatable here. She says, "My placement is with Efficiency Nova Scotia, the first energy efficient utility in Canada. This nonprofit organization focuses on decreasing the demand side of energy use and provides incentives, rebates, or financing and personalized consulting services to Nova Scotians for completing energy efficiency upgrades to their new or existing homes, businesses, or institutions. Funding for incentives, rebates, or financing for non-electrically heated homes was cut in the 2015 provincial budget. This is because a large portion of the organization's funding comes directly from fees charged on residents' electrical bills through Nova Scotia Power. As there are no fees applied directly to non-electrically heated homes, fuel bills, oil, natural gas, propane, etc., these homes and businesses can no longer take advantage of the services we provide. You've said that in order to make climate change action successful, we need to effect change at the lowest levels of the transaction. In Nova Scotia's case, it seems like the best way to get the funding back for non-electrically heated homes is to have a fee placed on non-electric homes' fuel bills. How can I advocate for this to change and for funding to be reinstalled for all Nova Scotians, regardless of fuel type? Thank you, Dr. Rand.
That's actually a great question. And first of all, it sounds like great work that this group is doing.
Yeah, it really does.
And that's actually a tough question. I'll do my best to answer. So I understand it. There's a fee applied to electrical bills. That fee funds energy efficiency utility, which goes around finding ways to be more efficient in energy use. And because it's not on, natural gas bills, then there's no funding for the natural gas side of things.
Right.
Well, first of all, I think what's really interesting here is the recognition in Nova Scotia that the utility is probably not the best place to implement energy efficiency programs.
Right.
Because, what utility is really motivated to sell less of their product? And I know there are well-meaning people in many utilities across the country who are tasked with doing exactly that, and I want to take nothing away from the good work they are doing. But fundamentally, in terms of the prime directive of that corporation, it's oil and water. So I think it will always be better placed and better done if handled by an arm's-length institution, which it looks like Nova Scotia set up. So I think that's absolutely brilliant. In terms of getting it onto the non-electrical side of things, well, first, I would note that there is a carbon price coming.
Sure.
It will be in all provinces, including Nova Scotia, and that may be a great source of funds for energy efficiency Nova Scotia to tap. And I would also note, adding to that, is fuel switching. If you're switching from natural gas to electricity, and you're working to get your electrical grid greener, fuel switching is one of the prime targets. So another way to do it, in other words, is to say, hey, electrical utility, why don't you fund us to do the non-electrical homes? Because a lot of the work that we're going to be doing will ultimately lead to them switching into highly efficient electrical heat pumps, for example.
Okay.
That's another way to maybe look at it.
Hmm.
And then the third way, of course, is to just simply say to the local gas company, emulate what the electrical guys are doing and have the provincial government mandate it on a gas bill in exactly the same way they've done it on the electrical bill. In other words, if what you're doing works on the electrical side, it's not a big leap to say, put this charge on the natural gas side, and we'll do that work there. Now, the fact that a price on carbon is coming means that the fee part of it is already in play. All you need to do is make the case that you want a portion of that fee. And the way you make that case is you just show the success of the program that you're operating currently and say, we want to do more of this good work. Thanks very much.
Well, that's excellent. I think that's a great answer and touches on all of her points there. I think Jenna will be very pleased with that as well. Thanks. The final question is from Steve, who is a presenter educator at the Foundation for Environmental Stewardship, is also part of the 3% Project. And the 3% Project mobilizes 1 million Canadian youth, that's 3% of Canada approximately, through 5 national tours across 600 schools. It provides youth-friendly and holistic education on climate change and empowers them to take action on solving climate change in their local communities today. Steve's question is as follows. Dear Dr. Rand, I think we all agree of the importance of climate change education, training, public awareness, and public participation, or how important all those are to fighting climate change. They are prerequisites for successful, lasting implementation of ambitious climate agendas. So why isn't there an appropriate level of funding for it, especially for young people, when the fossil fuel industry invested $558 million in the last 7 years to climate misinformation, creation, and delivery? It's a thinly veiled question, Steve.
Yeah, so I would note that existing industries are far better and more able to defend themselves than industries that aren't here yet.
Yeah, sure.
So the fact that fossil fuel sector is the elephant in the room means it can defend itself. It's got revenues, it's got employees, it's got capital. It is a very powerful industry.
Sure.
Nations industries, emerging industries, like the clean tech sector, because it's not yet a dominant player, has far less capacity to defend itself.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we'd have $500 million to spend on climate information would be a dream. But, the industry simply isn't there and can't do it yet. That said, it's growing. So, there are large, clean energy development companies that are out there. But at the end of the day, an industry that's got lots of money will defend itself.
Yeah.
So I think the only way around that is to simply be more effective than they are. There are lots of ways. I mean, it's like people who use social media intelligently disrupted the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
So just because they're big and just because they're powerful and just because they have lots of money doesn't mean they're effective.
Right.
So I would argue that you have to sort of mount a guerrilla campaign where, your ability to leverage, first of all, you have the truth is on your side, so that can't hurt.
Sure.
And then second of all, you just have to be faster, more mobile, and more creative than your opponent. And just try to outflank them in some way.
Well,
I think that's a great question, and that's the problem.
Yeah, it is. And I was fortunate to meet Steve. He's an extremely ambitious young man who has done an incredible amount of work already in his life. And he is the lead behind the 3% project. And very much as you said, I think you just need to prove you're more effective, and he has a very powerful argument for that. So we're partnering with him as he goes across the country with his public speaking engagements at the schools and the workshops that he's going to implement. So it's really an interesting project. I'll keep you informed just as he goes. I'll share a link with you just so you know a little bit more about it. Thanks for those answers, Tom. I'm sure all three participants will appreciate that. As a closing question, as I mentioned before, Canada Green Corps is a national youth employment program which aims to elevate the discourse around climate change issues, inspire youth and Canadians of all ages to identify most promising sustainability practices in their communities, and we're very broad in the types of work that we want them to do in terms of, or the types of practices that they might implement, whether it's related to energy efficiency or renewable energy or agriculture, transportation or food sustainability. There's a number of issues. But what advice would you have to our Green Corps members broadly and communities across Canada who wish to decrease their respective carbon footprints in a meaningful way? Where is the low-hanging fruit, Tom?
The low-hanging fruit is always inefficiency. I mean, efficiency is sort of the poor cousin of, sexy clean tech like solar and wind and energy storage and so on. But efficiency is always the low-hanging fruit. There's a famous curve that was put out almost a decade ago now called the McKinsey curve, which showed the relative cost of carbon abatement from negative costs, i.e. you make money doing it, insulation in your attic and all that kind of stuff, up to the stuff that's super expensive, like carbon sequestration.
Yeah.
And there's always efficiency that comes out way ahead.
Yeah.
So that's really the first place to start. And then once you've dealt with efficiency, then of course you're using less energy, and it's easier to replace that energy with something clean and renewable because there's simply less of it.
Right.
So I'd start with efficiency and then move into the energy production side. And I always, the big standby for me is, simple stuff like geothermal heat pumps, for example. That's a no-brainer, especially if you're living in a rural area where you've got lots of, just bury the pipe out of your yard or something.
Mm-hmm.
But efficiency, it always starts with efficiency and then goes from there.
No, that's a great answer. It's certainly true, and I know that, at least from some of the people I was speaking with back in Alberta, it wasn't immediately clear what they were going to do, if they're going to replace windows or, make the ceilings R60 or whatever. But people were thinking about those issues, and I think that's a powerful switch in thinking just in itself. And to lower the bar, as you said, to lower what we need to produce is fundamental as well. So. Well, this has been really wonderful, Tom. I'm sure that there'll be hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of Canadians who will be delighted to listen to the podcast. As I said, this is early days for the program, but we have great aspirations moving forward. I would encourage everyone who's listening to try and pick up Tom Rand's book, Waking the Frog. Solutions for our climate change paralysis, and to if you're traveling through Toronto, to check out Planet Traveler Hotel. I know the staff at UNA Canada are going to be taking a look and would like to test it out and see if any of the creature comforts are lost for sustainability, which Tom has promised in his book that they're not, and I'm sure they're not. Tom, did you have any parting words just to the group out there?
Well, you know, I would just part with something we mentioned partway through. There is absolutely nothing more formidable than an impassioned and articulate young person concerned about climate. So oftentimes, young people who express a desire to solve this problem are treated as being naive.
Right.
It is not naive, but all you need to do to get past that hump is there's just some basic information you can have about, you know, how economic models work, the promise of technology, that kind of thing. And if it doesn't take much to sort of be able to push back a little bit and make the case that it's actually naive to think we can keep doing what we're doing and make it to the end of this century. So I would encourage all the folks out there to stay the course. And believe me, a letter, that sounds so old-fashioned, letter to an MP or a meeting with a local civic leader or business leader from an impassioned young person is far more powerful than you think.
Those are fantastic words, and we're going to be having the Green Corps members contact their local papers for articles in those as well, and letters to MPs would be a great idea. Thank you for that, Tom. Quite inspiring, really. It was a pleasure having you on the show. We would love to have you back at some point in the future to follow up on a few issues, and really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.